All right, so let's be real for a second. When you think about your health insurance, where does it come from? Like, for most of us, it's probably tied to our jobs, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's like a big part of that whole benefits package you get when you start working somewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we're going to dive deep into today. We're talking all about group health insurance, how it works, why it exists, all the nitty-gritty details.
Sounds good to me.
So we've got some really fascinating stuff to work with today. Basically, a whole chapter from one of our sources that's entirely focused on group health insurance.
Wow, a whole chapter.
Yeah, so we're going to unpack all the key ideas, the things that everybody should know, but we'll also look for some of the surprising or unexpected aspects of how this whole system works. And of course, we'll break down the essential details of group health insurance here in the U.S.
It can definitely be a complicated topic.
It can be. That's why we're here to hopefully make it a little bit clear. All right, so first things first, what exactly is group health insurance?
Well, at its core, it's basically about covering a whole bunch of people under one single insurance contract. It's sort of like buying in bulk, you know? Instead of each person getting their own individual policy, you have this big umbrella that covers everyone in the group.
That's a good analogy, like a big giant insurance umbrella.
Right. And this idea, it's not exactly new. I mean, employers figured out a long time ago, like over 100 years ago, that offering health benefits was a pretty effective way to attract good employees and convince them to stay with the company.
It makes sense. I mean, healthcare is such a big expense for people.
Exactly. So it's been this essential tool for employers, really for generations.
Interesting. So we've got all these different types of group plans out there, right? Health insurance, life insurance, disability insurance, and probably more. What are some of the common threads that tie all these group plans together? What makes them distinct from individual policies?
Okay, so typically with group plans, you're only eligible to enroll if you meet certain criteria within the group. Like, you usually need to be an employee or a member of the organization sponsoring the plan. And then another big thing is cost. Group plans often end up being cheaper per person compared to buying an individual policy.
Right, because you're spreading the risk over a larger pool of people, right?
Exactly. That's the main idea. And here's another important factor. When you first become eligible to enroll in a group plan, most of the time, you don't have to prove that you're in good health. You don't need to go through a medical exam or answer a bunch of questions about your medical history.
That's a big difference from individual insurance, where you have to go through all that underwriting.
Absolutely. And then just one more key feature, many group plans will let you convert your coverage to an individual policy if you leave the group. So if you change jobs or retire, you might still be able to keep your coverage going, although the premiums might be different.
Okay, so we've got the basics of what group insurance is. Let's talk about who's involved. Who are the main players when we're talking about a group health insurance plan?
So you've got the insurance company, obviously. They're the ones actually providing the coverage and handling the claims.
Right, they're the ones paying the bills when someone goes to the doctor or the hospital.
Exactly. And then on the other side, you have what we call the sponsoring group. This is usually an employer, but it could also be a union or a professional association or even a group of employers banding together.
So whoever is setting up the plan and offering it to their employees or members.
Right. And they hold what's called the master policy. So they're the policy holder, the ones who have the main contract with the insurance company.
Okay, so we've got the insurance company and the sponsoring group. What about the actual people who are covered under the plan? The employees or members, where do they fit into this?
Well, the individual members of the group, they aren't actually parties to that main contract between the insurer and the sponsoring group.
Oh, interesting. So it's not like they're signing a contract directly with the insurance company.
Right. Instead, they get something called a certificate of coverage.
Certificate of coverage. What is that exactly?
It's basically like a little booklet or document that summarizes their benefits under the plan. It's their proof that they're covered.
Okay, so it outlines what the plan covers, what their deductibles and copays are, all that good stuff.
Yep, all the essential details. But here's the thing, the individual members, they don't have the authority to make changes to that main group policy. That power rests solely with the sponsoring group.
So if an employee wants to change their deductible or something, they can't just call up the insurance company and do it on their own.
Nope. Those kinds of decisions about the plan design are made by the sponsoring group, typically in consultation with the insurance company.
Got it. All right, let's talk money.
Sure.
Everyone wants to know how these premiums get calculated. How does the insurance company determine how much to charge for group health insurance?
Well, the most common way is through something called experience rating.
Experience rating, I've heard of that. What does it mean?
Basically, it means that the insurer looks back at the group's past experience with healthcare claims. Like how many people filed claims, how much did those claims cost? They use that data to try to predict how much they'll have to pay out in the future.
So if a company has had a lot of employees getting sick and needing expensive treatments, their premiums are probably going to be higher, right?
Exactly. And on the flip side, if everyone's been relatively healthy and there haven't been many big claims, their premiums might be lower.
Makes sense. So it's all about looking at the history of that specific group.
Right. And one more thing to note, larger and more homogeneous groups, like companies where most employees are around the same age and health status, their past experience is likely to be a better predictor of future costs. So their rates might be more reflective of a kind of standard or average cost.
So a company with 1,000 employees who are all in their 30s might have more predictable healthcare costs than a company with only 50 employees spread across different age groups and health conditions.
Thanks.
Okay, I think we've got experience rating down. What about community rating? How is that different?
Community rating takes a completely different approach. It basically throws out the idea of looking at one specific group's history.
Interesting. So what does it look at instead?
Well, with community rating, everyone who signs up for a particular health insurance plan in a certain geographic area, maybe a county or a state, they all pay the same premium rate structure.
So it doesn't matter how healthy or unhealthy your specific group has been in the past.
Nope, it's all about spreading the risk across a much broader community.
Makes sense. So under community rating, you could have a company with super healthy employees paying the same rate as a company with employees who have a lot of health issues.
Exactly. But just one important thing to remember, regardless of whether it's experience rating or community rating, premiums for group insurance, the kind you get through your job, are generally going to be lower than what you'd pay for an individual policy.
That's good to know. So there's definitely a financial advantage to being part of a group plan. Now let's talk about who can actually offer these plans in the first place. Can any group of people get together and call themselves a group to get those lower rates?
Not quite. There's a really important rule here. The group has to be formed for a reason other than just getting insurance.
Like, it can't be a bunch of random people who just want cheaper health insurance.
Right. They have to have a legitimate reason for existing, what's called a natural group. And then the insurance is sort of a secondary benefit that comes along with it.
Okay, so give us some examples of these natural groups that are allowed to sponsor group health insurance plans.
Okay, the most obvious one is employers, right? Most people get their health insurance through their jobs.
Right. Those are your typical employer-sponsored group plans.
Exactly. But you also have something called multiple employer trusts, or METs. These are basically ways for smaller employers, maybe in the same industry, to band together and buy insurance as a larger entity.
So like a group of small restaurants, or maybe all the dentists in a town, could they form a METee?
Yeah, something like that. It allows those smaller businesses to get access to better rates that they might not qualify for on their own.
That's smart. It's like they're creating a bigger pool by joining forces.
Right. Then you have multiple employment welfare arrangements, or MUWAs. These are kind of similar to MEETs, but they allow unrelated employers to come together.
So not necessarily in the same industry.
Right. So you could have a tech company teaming up with a manufacturing company, for example, to offer health insurance to all their employees together.
Interesting. It's like they're creating more diverse risk pool that way.
Exactly. And then, of course, you have labor unions. They often sponsor group health plans for their members.
Right. Unions are all about collective bargaining and getting good benefits for their members.
And sometimes you have multiple unions coming together under something called a Taft-Hartley Trust to provide insurance for all their members collectively.
Okay. So we've got employers, groups of employers, unions. What else?
Trade associations, professional organizations, those kinds of groups can also sponsor plans for their members.
So like a group of doctors or lawyers could have their own group health plan.
Exactly. And then there's one more category that's kind of unique, lenders and creditors.
Wait, lenders can offer health insurance?
Well, it's specifically group credit disability insurance, which is a little different.
Oh, so it's not like regular health insurance. What does it cover?
It protects the lender if the borrower becomes disabled and can't repay their loan. So if the borrower gets sick or injured and can't work, this insurance will make the loan payments for them.
Okay, that makes sense. It's protecting the lender's investment.
Exactly. And in this case, the benefits are actually paid to the lender, not to the borrower.
Interesting. So it's really a way to safeguard the loan.
Right. And the coverage amount is limited to the outstanding debt.
So if you owe $10,000 on your car loan, that's the most the insurance will pay out.
Exactly. It's very specific to that particular loan.
Okay, that's a really interesting niche type of group insurance. All right, let's focus now on the most common type, employer-sponsored group health plans. Let's get into some of the specifics of how these plans work. We know that with individual health insurance, the insurance company spends a lot of time evaluating your health history before they'll offer you a policy. They want to know if you're healthy or if you have any pre-existing conditions. How does that work when it's a group of people?
Yeah, that's a key difference between individual and group underwriting. With group plans, the insurer isn't really looking at each individual employee's health status in detail. They're more concerned with the overall risk of the entire group as a whole.
So it's like they're looking at the forest, not the individual trees.
Exactly. They'll consider things like the average age of the employees, the type of industry they work in, any health trends that might be common in that industry, and things like that. They also look closely at the design of the health plan itself, what benefits are included, what the deductibles and co-pays are, to get a sense of the potential costs.
So if the plan covers a lot of expensive procedures or has really low deductibles, the premiums are probably going to be higher, right?
Right, because they're anticipating having to pay out more in claims. And because of this group approach to underwriting, most employees don't have to go through a full medical exam or answer a ton of health questions to get coverage. Usually, it's just a simple enrollment form.
So it's much easier to get coverage under a group plan.
Yes, much less hassle. But of course, the insurer still needs to assess the risk, right? So, what are the key factors that group underwriters look at when they're deciding whether to offer coverage to a particular group and how much to charge them?
Good question. So if they're not focusing on individual health, what are they looking at?
Okay, well, the size of the group is a big one.
Size, like the number of employees.
Exactly. Larger groups tend to be more attractive to insurers.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, with more people, you're more likely to have a more stable and predictable pattern of healthcare claims. It's less likely that one or two really sick people will throw off the whole system.
So it's like a larger sample size makes the data more reliable.
Exactly. And larger groups also tend to be less susceptible to something called adverse selection.
Adverse selection, what's that?
It's basically the idea that people who know they're going to need a lot of health care are more likely to sign up for insurance. So if you have a small group and a few people with chronic illnesses join the plan, that could really drive up the costs for everyone.
Because the insurance company is suddenly paying out way more in claims than they expected.
Right. Larger groups help to mitigate that risk. And just to put some numbers on it, the source we're looking at defines a small group as having between 2 and 50 employees, and a large group has 51 or more.
Okay, so size definitely matters. What else do underwriters consider?
Well, they'll also look at the composition of the group, the demographics, things like the average age of the employees, the ratio of men to women, even the income levels in some cases.
So if a company has a lot of older employees or a lot of women of childbearing age, they might be considered higher risk.
Exactly. They'll also look at the flow of members through a group.
Flow of members, you mean how often people are joining and leaving the company?
Right. Regular turnover with people coming and going is generally seen as a good thing by insurers.
Really? Why is that?
Well, again, it helps to maintain a healthier balance of risk within the group. It reduces the chances of adverse selection.
Interesting. So a company where people tend to stay for decades might be seen as slightly higher risk than a company with more turnover.
Yeah, potentially. And of course, they look very closely at the plan design.
You mean what's covered by the plan?
Exactly. The specific medical services that are included, the deductible, the co-pays, the co-insurance, all of those things have a big impact on the cost.
Right. A plan with a lot of bells and whistles is going to cost more than a bare bones plan.
Exactly.
Right.
And then you have contributory versus non-contributory plans, and those are also important from an underwriting perspective.
Can you remind us what those are?
Sure. In a contributory plan, the employees pay a portion of the premium.
So it's shared between the employer and the employees.
Right. And in those cases, the insurer usually wants to see a certain level of participation, like at least 75% of eligible employees signing up.
To make sure they're spreading the risk effectively.
Exactly. With a non-contributory plan, the employer pays the whole premium for everyone.
So it's like a free benefit for the employees.
Exactly. And in those cases, participation is usually 100% because, well, everyone gets covered automatically.
Makes sense. So higher participation is generally a good thing from the insurer's perspective.
Absolutely. It means they're pooling a larger group of people, which, as we've talked about, is good for managing risk. And just a few more factors that underwriters consider. They like to see persistency.
Persistency. What does that mean?
It basically means that the employer has kept their group health coverage with the same insurance company for several years in a row.
So it's like loyalty to a particular insurer.
Right. And that stability can sometimes lead to lower premiums over time because the insurer doesn't have to keep setting up new plans and going through that whole process. And then finally, they might also consider the administrative capability of the employer, particularly for larger companies.
What does that mean?
Well, if the employer has the resources and the systems in place to handle some of the administrative tasks themselves, like managing enrollments and processing certain types of claims, that can sometimes translate into lower premium costs.
So it's like the employer is doing some of the work that the insurance company would normally have to do.
Exactly. And that efficiency can save everyone money.
All right. So the underwriter is looking at all these factors: the size of the group, the demographics, the flow of employees, the plan design, how premiums are paid, persistency, administrative capabilities. It's a lot to consider.
It is. It's a holistic view of the group and its potential risks.
Okay, now let's talk about who gets to be covered under these employer-sponsored plans. What are the rules around eligibility?
Well, when it comes to employee eligibility, the main thing is non-discrimination.
Meaning you can't exclude certain employees just because you think they might be higher risk?
Exactly. Employers cannot discriminate based on age, disabilities, or sex. And it's super important to note that pregnancy and maternity-related conditions, those have to be treated just like any other medical condition.
So you can't deny coverage or charge a woman more just because she's pregnant?
Nope, that's illegal. It's considered discrimination. However, employers are allowed to set some basic job-related criteria for eligibility.
Like what?
Well, typically you have to be working full-time or at least a certain number of hours per week to qualify, and you have to be actively at work, meaning not on disability leave or something like that.
Makes sense. What about union employees? Are they typically covered under the employer's plan?
It depends. Sometimes union members are covered under a separate plan that's negotiated through collective bargaining, but other times they might be included in the employer's main plan.
Okay, so there's some flexibility there. What about family members? Who else can typically be covered under an employee's health insurance?
Well, coverage has to be offered to the employee's spouse and their children.
Okay, so husband and wife and kids.
Right. And the coverage for children usually extends up to age 26.
So even if they're out of college and living on their own, they can still be on their parents' plan.
Yep, that's right. And that includes stepchildren and adopted children, regardless of whether the child is married or a student.
Okay, that's pretty generous. What about kids who are older than 26, but maybe they have a disability that prevents them from supporting themselves?
Many states actually have laws requiring coverage for those situations.
So even adult children with disabilities might still be eligible.
Exactly. It varies by state, but it's definitely something to be aware of.
Okay, good to know. So let's say someone starts a new job. They're all excited. They get hired. Is there usually a waiting period before they can actually enroll in the company's health plan?
Yes. It's really common for employers to have a probationary period or a waiting period before new hires become eligible for benefits.
So you might have to work there for a few months before you can get on the health plan.
Right. And the length of those waiting periods can vary, but typically it's somewhere between 1 and 6 months.
Okay, so once that waiting period is over, how does the employee actually sign up for coverage?
Well, after that initial waiting period, there's usually an eligibility period or an enrollment period. It's usually around 30 days.
So a window of time when they can enroll in the plan?
Exactly. And on top of that initial enrollment period, most states require insurers to offer what's called an open enrollment period once a year.
Open enrollment. I've definitely heard of that. It's usually in the fall, right?
Yeah, often in the fall. And that open enrollment period is really important because it allows employees who initially decline coverage to sign up without having to prove they're healthy.
So it's like a second chance to get on the plan.
Right. If you said no to coverage when you first started your job, you can change your mind during open enrollment.
Got it. That's a really important safety net for people. Now, what happens if someone misses both their initial enrollment period and the open enrollment? Can they still get coverage later on if they want it?
It's possible, but it's usually more complicated.
Yep.
If you try to enroll outside those designated periods, you might be considered a late enrollee. And in those cases, the insurer might require you to provide evidence of insurability.
So they might want you to go through a medical exam to prove you're healthy.
Exactly. It's a way for them to manage their risk and make sure people aren't just waiting until they get sick to sign up.
Okay, that makes sense. Now let's imagine a situation that's pretty common these days. You have a married couple. Both spouses work, and they both have health insurance through their respective employers.
Mm.
How does that work? Who pays the bills if one of them gets sick?
That's a really good question, and it gets into the idea of coordination of benefits.
Coordination of benefits. So it's about figuring out which insurance plan pays first.
Exactly. You don't want someone getting double coverage and potentially profiting from getting sick, right?
Right. That wouldn't make any sense. So how does coordination of benefits actually work?
Okay, so when someone is covered under more than one group health plan, there's a process to determine which plan is primary and which is secondary.
Primary and secondary, what's the difference?
The primary plan pays up to its limits first, and then if there are any eligible expenses left over, the secondary plan might kick in and cover those.
Okay, so it's like a first line of defense and then a backup.
Exactly. Now, in the case of a married couple, each person's own employer-sponsored plan is considered primary for their own medical care.
So if I have insurance through my job and my spouse has insurance through their job, my plan would pay first for my doctor's visits and my spouse's plan would pay first for their doctor's visits.
Exactly. And then their plan would be secondary for you and your plan would be secondary for them.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about for their kids? If both parents have coverage, how do they decide which plan is primary for the children?
For kids, they use what's called the birthday rule.
Birthday rule? Never heard of that.
It's simple, really. The health plan of the parent whose birthday comes earlier in the year is the primary plan for the kids.
So if my birthday is in January and my spouse's birthday is in July, my plan would be primary for our children.
Exactly. Easy peasy.
I love it. The birthday rule. I need to remember that. What happens in cases where the parents are separated or divorced? Whose plan is primary then?
Usually, the plan of the parent who has custody of the child is considered primary.
So the parent who the child lives with most of the time.
Right. Unless, of course, there's a court order or some other legal agreement that says otherwise.
Makes sense. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Let's talk about marketing.
Mm-hmm.
How are these group health insurance plans actually sold? Are there rules about what insurance companies can and cannot say when they're trying to get employers to sign up with them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. States have all kinds of regulations in place that govern how accident and health insurance policies can be marketed and advertised. And those rules definitely apply to group health plans.
So it's not like the Wild West out there.
Nope. The main goal is to make sure that the information being presented to potential buyers is honest and accurate.
So no misleading claims or hiding important details in the fine print.
Right. They have to be upfront about the benefits the policy offers, and they can't make promises they can't keep.
Transparency is key.
Exactly. And the insurance company itself is ultimately responsible for the content of their ads.
So they can't just blame it on their marketing department if they get caught bending the rules.
Nope. The buck stops with the insurer.
Okay. That makes sense. What about the legal side of things? Which state's laws apply to a particular group health insurance policy?
Typically, it's the state where the policy is delivered to the employer, assuming that's also where the employer's main business is located.
So if the company is headquartered in California, but they have employees all over the country, it would be California law that governs the plan.
Most likely, yes. But things can get more complicated if you have companies and insurers operating across state lines. Then you might have multiple states involved in the regulatory oversight.
Right. Multi-state situations are always more complex.
They are.
All right, let's talk about change. What happens when an employer decides to change their group health insurance plan, maybe switch to a different insurer or go with a completely different type of plan? Are there any protections in place for the employees during those transitions?
Yes, there are a few things that help smooth the transition.
So employees aren't just left high and dry with a brand new plan they don't understand.
Right. One common provision is for what's called coinsurance and deductible carryover.
That sounds familiar. What does it mean?
Well, let's say you've already paid a certain amount towards your deductible or coinsurance under your old plan. When you switch to the new plan, the new insurer might credit those amounts towards the requirements of the new plan.
So you don't have to start from scratch with your out-of-pocket costs every time the plan changes.
Exactly. It's like you get to take your progress with you.
That's a good thing. What about people who are already receiving benefits for a disability or a chronic condition?
Many states have what are called no loss, no gain laws.
No loss, no gain. What does that mean in this context?
Basically, it means that if an employee has an ongoing disability claim and that claim started while the old plan was in effect, those benefits have to continue to be paid under the old plan, even if the employer switches to a new insurer.
So they can't just cut off someone's benefits because they changed insurance companies.
Right. The new plan can't impose its own eligibility requirements on those pre-existing claims. It provides some important continuity for people who are already receiving benefits.
That's a huge relief for people dealing with ongoing health issues. Now, let's talk about when coverage might end. What are some of the common reasons why someone might lose their coverage under a group health insurance plan?
Well, a lot of things can happen, right?
Yeah, life happens.
Exactly. For one, the employer could decide to discontinue the health plan altogether.
So they just stop offering health insurance as a benefit.
Right. Or maybe they decide to stop offering coverage to a certain class of employees, maybe part-time workers or something like that.
Okay. So the employer could make that call.
Yep. And sometimes the group policy itself might lapse, meaning it terminates, because the employer didn't pay the premiums.
Oh, wow. So the whole plan could just go away if the company doesn't keep up with the payments.
Unfortunately, that can happen. And then on a more individual level, an employee might lose their coverage, or their dependents might, if they don't pay their share of the premiums, if it's a contributory plan.
So if you forget to pay your portion, you could lose your health insurance.
Yep. And of course, if you quit your job or get laid off, your coverage usually ends.
Unless you have COBRA, right?
Right. We'll talk about COBRA in a minute. But yeah, if you lose your job, you typically lose your health insurance unless you opt for COBRA. And then there are some other situations, like if an employee gets divorced, their spouse might lose coverage.
Okay, that makes sense. And children, they obviously age out of the plan eventually.
Right. Once a dependent child turns 26, they're no longer eligible, unless they have a disability, as we talked about earlier.
So lots of potential reasons why someone might lose their group health coverage. Are there ever any situations where benefits might continue even after the policy terminates or someone leaves the group?
Yes, sometimes. There's something called extension of benefits. Some states have laws that require benefits to continue for a certain period, even after a policy ends, if the person was already receiving those benefits for a specific medical condition.
So it's like a grace period to allow people to transition to a new plan or find other coverage.
Right. And this is particularly relevant for people who are totally disabled. They might have a right to continued coverage even if the policy ends.
Okay, good to know. And then there's COBRA, the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act.
Mm.
What is COBRA all about?
COBRA. It's a very important federal law.
I've definitely heard of it, but I'm not exactly sure what it does.
Well, it basically requires most employers with 20 or more employees to offer their former employees and their eligible dependents the option to continue their health coverage for a certain period after a qualifying event.
A qualifying event? What's that?
It's basically any event that would normally cause someone to lose their health coverage. So things like getting fired or laid off, a reduction in work hours, getting divorced, a dependent child turning 26, those are all qualifying events.
So it's like a safety net to help people bridge the gap in coverage when they're going through a major life change.
Exactly. But here's the thing. The person who elects COBRA has to pay the full premium for that continued coverage themselves.
So it's not free.
Nope. They have to pay both the portion they were paying before plus the portion their employer was contributing.
Wow, that could get expensive.